I'm sure you're aware that there's a well-known phrase in English which says, don't judge a book by its cover. And as you know, that phrase applies to much more than books. But then it does apply to books as well. How often have we been attracted to a book? Or perhaps how often have we been put off from reading a book entirely on the basis of the title on the front cover? For example, I recently mentioned a book to Michael, a book which I thought he might have found interesting, only to discover that he was put off from reading it because of the title. And that's a pity, because the title is not a fair reflection of what the book is about. And so I will give him the book to have a read at when he's got time. And what is true of that particular book could also be said to be true of the fourth book of the Bible, the book of Numbers. Now, if you follow the church's Bible reading plan, then you will have started to work your way through the book of Numbers. And based on what you've read so far, you may have come to the conclusion that the title is a fair reflection of the book. And I say that because the opening chapters do contain a lot of numbers. And when you get to chapter 26, there will be even more numbers. But even if numbers is not your thing, or if mathematics wasn't your favourite subject at school, then please don't be put off from reading the book of Numbers, because the book contains so much more than numbers. And what I want to do this evening is look at the verses at the close of chapter 3. And yes, it's a passage which contains a little bit of maths, but contained in the maths is a vitally important biblical principle. If you're using a church Bible, you'll see that the title for chapter 3 is the Levites. Now, the Levites, you may remember, were that one tribe out of 12 within the nation of Israel that was set apart for service at the tabernacle and then later at the temple. So, for example, in verse 7, we hear God saying, they are to perform duties for him and for the whole community at the tent of meeting by doing the work of the tabernacle. Their work was prescribed by God. And the reason God can specify what their work should consist of is because, end of verse 12, the Levites are mine. The Levites are mine. Now, as we discovered this morning, God has authority over all people everywhere because he is the creator of all people. But having been redeemed from Egypt, the nation of Israel belonged to God in an even greater sense. They were his as a result of both creation and redemption. But what this chapter is pointing out is that within the nation of Israel, the Levites belong to God in an even greater sense still. And how did that come about? Well, the explanation for the Levites goes all the way back to the record of the Passover in Exodus chapter 12. And in verse 12 of that chapter, we hear God saying, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and I will strike down every firstborn, both men and animals. And then in chapter Exodus 13, we hear God saying to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn male. The male, the first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether man or animal. Now, strictly speaking, every firstborn in Egypt that night should have died. Egyptian and Israelite. Every firstborn should have died. But in his grace, and through the provision of a substitute in the form of the Passover lamb, the firstborn amongst the Israelites were spared. And so although all of Israel was being rescued and redeemed that night, there was a sense in which the firstborn in Israel was being redeemed in a special sense. And having been redeemed by God in a special sense, they belong to God in a special sense. And that is why the firstborn sons were to be consecrated to the Lord. But now that they're getting ready to set off for the promised land, God is exchanging the firstborns in Israel with the Levites in Israel. And that is why there is the need for this census, for this count that we read about in chapter 3. The Levites are counted in verse 39, and the firstborns are counted in verse 43 to make sure that it is a fair exchange, to make sure that the numbers add up. And did you notice how precise and how particular God was in that process? If you compare verse 39 with verse 43, you'll see there is a difference of 273. And what does God do about that? Does he say, oh, just forget it? What, after all, is 273 when we're talking about tens of thousands? No, he doesn't. Instead, he tells the Israelites in verse 46 that if they want to redeem those 273 firstborns, they'll need to pay 5 shekels each into the Levite fund. Having redeemed the firstborn in a special sense, God sees himself as having ownership of them in a special sense. So much so that those who cannot be substituted by a Levite have to be bought back. While those Levites who do replace the firstborn, they now become the ones who belong to God in a special sense. And as such, they are now the ones who are consecrated to God in the service of the tabernacle. And so whereas the other Israelites were free to be or to do what they wanted to be in life, whether that was whether they wanted to be farmers or whether they wanted to be bakers or builders or fishermen or school teachers or whatever, the Levites weren't free. They weren't free to do whatever they wanted in life. They were required to do work specifically related to the worship of God at the tabernacle, for the simple reason they were God's possession. The Levites are mine, says the Lord. And did you know that is still a principle that applies to you and me this evening if we are Christians? And what is more, the explanation for it still goes all the way back to the Passover. Well, not the Passover of Exodus 12, but a Passover many years later, which Exodus 12 was ultimately pointing forward to. As you remember, Jesus' instruction to his disciples in Luke 22, go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover. I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. And within 24 hours of saying those words, Jesus suffered as our Passover lamb. And so just as the Passover lambs of Exodus 12 died in the place of those Israelite firstborn, as God swept through the land of Egypt in judgment, so Jesus died in our place as God pours out his wrath and judgment on Calvary. And that is why Paul can say in 1 Corinthians 5, for Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Just as those Israelite firstborn found safety and security through sheltering under the blood of the Passover lamb, and so it is sheltering under the shed blood of our Passover lamb that you and I find safety and security and salvation this evening. And as a result of his infinitely greater sacrifice, It isn't just 1 in 12 of God's people that now serve as priests and offer sacrifices. No. All of God's people are now consecrated as priests in God's service. That is why Peter can say to the Christians, all the Christians of his day, he says, you also, like living stones, have been built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. The priesthood is not something that applies to a few special Christians. No, Peter's writing to all the Christians. He says, you are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. As John says in the opening chapter of his Revelation, he says, Christ has freed us from our sins by his blood and has made us to be a kingdom and priests to serve his God and Father. And therefore the application of Numbers 3 today is not to a small number of God's people who happen to be employed by the church or who happen to work in full-time Christian service. No, the application of it is to every Christian. Having been redeemed by the precious blood of Christ, the Christian belongs to God in the fullest sense of the word. Isn't that great news tonight? It is. But one of the implications of that is that as a result of belonging to God, we cannot be and we cannot do as we please. Did you know that? Yes, you can be a baker or a butcher or a school teacher or a fisherman if you want to be. But in another more important sense, you cannot be or do as you please. Is that not what Paul is teaching in that passage we read from? 1 Corinthians 6. As you probably know, first century Corinth was a place where people did whatever they wanted to do, whatever they felt like doing, regardless of how moral or immoral it was. And as our society, as hedonism and pleasure become the new gods of our society, we too find ourselves in a very similar situation. We too find ourselves daily facing the temptation of doing whatever we feel like doing. That is the motto of our society. If it feels good, just do it. Do whatever you think brings you the greatest pleasure. It sounds so attractive. But if you are a Christian this evening, then you and I need to remember that we cannot do whatever we want to do. And why not? For the same reason that the Old Testament Israelites, and especially the Old Testament Levites, couldn't do whatever they liked to do. And that is 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19. You are not your own. You were bought at a price. If you are a Christian this evening, then never forget that someone has bought you. Someone has paid a price for you. Someone has redeemed you. And as we've seen in the case of the firstborn and then the Levites, redemption leads to rightful possession, which leads to binding obligations. Having redeemed us, God has made us his very own. We are his possession. And that is why Paul concludes in 1 Corinthians 6 by saying, you cannot do whatever you please. Instead, you ought to honour God with your body. We live in a very individualistic society where everyone likes to think that they're their own man or their own woman, and therefore they can do their own thing, regardless of what others think or feel about it. But as a Christian, we cannot think like that for the simple reason that we are not our own man. We are not our own woman. And part of the purpose which this communion table serves is that it is a regular reminder that we are not our own. It is a regular reminder that we belong to someone else this evening. God has purchased us, and as a result, we belong to Him in a very special sense. And this table serves as a regular reminder of the price that He has paid in order to make us His very own possession. The price that He has paid in order to make us His very own people. He has done so with the precious blood of His own dear Son. That is the price that God has paid in order to purchase you. That is the price that God has paid in order to make you His own. And therefore, if anything in the life of the church ought to help us and ought to encourage us and ought to motivate us to live for God in this world, then surely there is this occasion when we remember the means and the cost of our redemption. That is why at the close of his chapter, in writing to the Corinthians about immorality, his closing argument is that you're not your own. You were bought with a price. And if anything ought to help us to live for God out there in this world, it ought to be that reminder that we're not our own. We're bought with a price. And what was that price? Well, says Peter, you know what it is. You know that it's not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. And having been purchased at such a great price, far greater than all the gold or silver of this world could ever accomplish, having been purchased at such a great price, surely it ought to be our ambition during this week and in the weeks ahead to live for God's honour. We are not our own. We belong to Him.